Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I forgive me for interrupting conversations, and I also have to apologize to you. We had some confusion, and some people in the delegation thought that we were starting at 2:30, and all of you thought we were starting at 2, and so unfortunately I apologize that we've caused a little confusion here, so we'll have a bunch of people arriving here shortly. And I thank all of you. I thank all of you for coming. And I'm really delighted you're here. I'm delighted that that Mr. Al-Otman is here with us. I've just had a very interesting conversation with him about Aramco, his experiences here in the United States. You know, he's a graduate of our universities, very, very familiar with America, and I think very much welcomes a chance to work with this country as a partner country. And we just talked about how damn frustrating it was that his kids can't get visas to come to school here. I mean, it's one of the great shames, you know, that we have right now, the way that we are still so paranoid after 9/11 that we can't tell the difference between a friend and somebody we don't know. And unfortunately, that plagues us every day. And so I personally want to apologize to you for that. I hope that you'll still give us another chance to get this right. We got to work on it. Welcome, everybody. This is going to be a very interesting time, and I'm especially grateful to hear Abdel-Latif for coming today, and thank him for coming today and continuing this remarkable trend that's been set by Saudi Aramco for providing such openness and transparency about its operations as a company. This really has been a tremendous thing over the last 3 to 4 years. We've been very grateful to have had the participation of the company and his colleagues. Mr. Juma has been with us, I think, the last 3 years. Minister Naimi has been with us the last 3 years. And it really is quite a thing when you reflect on it, that there was a lot of strain and tension between Saudi Arabia and the United States from 9/11 on. And I honestly think, had it not been for the strength and the confidence of Aramco, that things would be a lot worse. I think you kept a dialogue and an openness going between us when we needed it, and we needed it very much. And I think we've all benefited from it. I hope that it's been beneficial for Aramco. I know it certainly has been beneficial for the policy community in Washington. And this is going to be yet another opportunity to take it to a deeper understanding of the remarkable work that's underway. So I want to thank you for being with us today. I want to thank you for the continuing partnership that we have with Aramco to share with the policy community in Washington the important work that is underway. Please do come in. Please come in. I'm just vamping for time, and I apologize that we got the timing wrong on your end. So welcome. We're delighted that you're all here. So, Mr. Al-Otman, I really want to thank you, and I will turn it over to you because we are anxious to hear you. Nobody wants to hear me. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hammer. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's really a great pleasure for me to be here at the CSIS, an organization that occupies center stage when it comes to U.S. energy issues, as well as many. We at Saudi Aramco truly admire the organization for the quality of work it generates and very proud of the relationship that we've developed through the years. I know our oil minister, His Excellency Ali Naimi, came here. Our president and CEO came here. Several of our executives and professionals came here and talk to you about the oil scene, the energy, the global energy issues, talk to you about our programs. And I thought of doing something slightly different this time. And I hope you would find it to be insightful, things that often you don't think of when you hear about national oil companies. I wanted to talk more about the organizational capabilities, the people skills, and the governance that lies behind this organization and help us deliver. I will start my presentation first by a quick background on the energy situation, the programs that we have underway, but really the main theme of my presentation is about the organizational capabilities and the governance and the people that we have that lies behind this company that the world calls Saudi Aramco. So we'll do this, and hopefully after that we'll have questions and answers, and hopefully we'll be able to address them. The world is enjoying historic economic performance, aided by increased trade and economic liberalization, growing since 1990 substantially. And average growth projections is about 3.4% for the next 5 years. You look at the economic outlook, it's creating more demand for energy as we move forward, and you see non-OECD driving the growth. However, OECD provides a stable growth opportunity. And as can be seen here, oil demand is correlated with economic output. Although the energy intensity levels vary, you see that the non-OECD require more energy to produce a unit of GDP. Here is a nice quote on oil demand looking forward. World oil use is expected to grow from 78 million barrels per day in 2002, which is currently 86 million barrels per day, to 103 million barrels per day in 2015, and 119 million barrels per day in 2025. I understand that the number has been slightly reduced down to 100, but the point, I think, stays the same, is that the world needs energy. Key features of the demand growth is that developing economies will be the main contributor to the demand growth. And demand growth will be highest for transportation, fuels, as well as feedstock. And the U.S. will lead the developed world growth, while China will lead the developing world growth. And the same thing here about China growth. And if you look at the supply history, the world oil supply base has always been global, with demand dominated by the developed world. Moving forward, the supply picture will continue to be dominated by trade, with imports expected to rise in the coming years. This is a very important graph that I'm sure some of you have seen in the past. But the point from this is that there is ample resources available for energy. The world has consumed only one-third of the world proven reserves, but if you add to it the non-conventional, if you add to it the possible and probable, there is plenty of oil. And if you look at the supply outlook, non-OPEC supply growth will be primarily non-conventional, falling outside the OECD, and dependency on OPEC supplies will increase over the years. And as you look at the OPEC role, I think there is a very nice quote from here from McKinsey, which basically says that the key with regards to OPEC output is the timely investments and the ability to make these investments. And I will touch on the role Saudi Aramco is playing, and I'm sure other key players are doing the same. And the message behind it is that we don't have issues below the ground, and most of the issues are above the ground. It's deliverability and not availability. Obviously, we're in a business that is cyclic by its nature, and there is a cycle that affects organizations as they go about in making their investment decisions. But the challenge we face, as I said, it's more than just an upstream challenge. You have issues with refining capacity, you have issues with shipping, you have issues with boutique fuel specifications, regulatory environment, as well as geopolitics, that all affects the deliverability aspects of the industry. And the industry can be best characterized by a high degree of uncertainty that makes decisions extremely difficult, especially investment decisions. If the industry is not getting a clear signal from the market, investment decisions become very, very hard. And this is a nice quotation. The uncertainties over future oil demand and non-OPEC supply translate into a broad range of demand levels for OPEC oil. This complicates the planning for appropriate and timely investment in OPEC countries. And what it underscores is the importance for consuming nations and producing nations to collaborate and ensure that there is a good flow of information to make appropriate and timely investment decisions. Saudi Arabia has a prominent role with regards to responding to the market needs. And our president and CEO said the kingdom has long played a thoughtful and responsible role in the global oil market, and the wisdom of the policies articulated by our government have been amply demonstrated time and time again. And I also would like to quote Mr. Ebel here. Saudi Arabia has been one of the very few highly reliable producers, exporters of the past 30 years. Its performance in providing the world with incremental supply in time of need is unsurpassed. We have very ambitious upstream expansion plans, and my colleagues, when they came here in the past, shared with you the various activities we're doing. We plan to increase our maximum sustained capacity from 10.8 million barrels per day to 12 million barrels per day. And what you see before you here are several projects that are well underway and on track to achieve that increase in maximum sustained capacity. Similarly, we're also playing a critical role on the downstream part, and we're expanding our total refining network, including a major expansion in our Motiva joint venture here in the United States, Port Arthur Refinery. We also have two grassroots export-oriented refineries that we've signed memorandum of understanding with Total and ConocoPhillips. We have PetroRabo and various domestic petrochemical integration projects. Our joint venture in Korea, S-Oil, is also going through a steady stage of a grassroots refinery. We're also, along with ExxonMobil and Sinopec, doing a feasibility study on two refineries in China, Fujian and Qingdao. So what you see is that our response is global and bold when it comes to the downstream as well. And the key summaries of the current situation is that economic prosperity is driving oil demand, that the issues that we have has much more to do with above the ground than with below the surface. There is a refining capacity tightness and under-investment apparent throughout the value chain. And there are factors other than supply and demand fundamentals that are affecting the current price environment. And Saudi Aramco has ambitious plans, both upstream and downstream, to play its role. Now, this takes me to the main theme of my presentation, which is behind the success. What's behind the success? Beyond just natural resources. It's not just simply bring in an increment or open a tab and here is more production. It takes a lot of effort for an organization to deliver. And before I talk about Saudi Aramco, I think it's important that people also realize the history of Saudi Aramco. The history of Saudi Aramco is about a successful partnership between the government of Saudi Arabia back in 1933 and amongst the best major oil companies in the United States. And then gradually Saudi Arabia bought, increased its shares until it assumed full ownership. However, the management practices and the capabilities were built upon and kept and evolved with time as our complexity and the nature of our business have changed. So many people, when you hear about national oil companies, do not relate it to the management practices and the skills and the capabilities that often are thought of when you talk about world-class commercial corporations. And what I hope I will be able to convey to you is that the same principles and the same discipline is being maintained. There are key strategic drivers guiding the company. One is to be globally responsive to the global needs. Let me see here. Close. Yes. A global responsiveness is a key strategic driver for us, as well as maintaining commerciality of our business model, where we maintain the competitive edge in the market and to be profit-driven. We also recognize that we have a critical role to the kingdom as a main contributor to the revenues for the government, but also as a key contributor to diversifying and enabling economic growth. And we do that while keeping our mind alert on the commercial aspects of our business. Now, allow me to elaborate. And I will be elaborating about these critical success factors each. Sound management practices and business principles. Organizations to succeed also have to have solid corporate governance framework, leading-edge technology programs. We have relentless commitment to talent development and deeply held corporate social responsibility culture throughout the organization. When I talk about sound management practices and business principles, it's the commercial mindset, metric-driven performance management capabilities. Being in a capital-intensive business, we maintain strict capital discipline where all our projects are evaluated on a commercial basis, tested, stress-tested for various scenarios before we make the decision. We also focus on being operationally excellent. And by that I mean you manage execution and you make sure that you employ efficient and effective processes. Being in a capital-intensive business, we recognize that project management capabilities has to be a core competency. And we've received many recognitions on our capabilities of bringing about mega projects, recognitions from the Project Management Institute, the Construction Industry Institutes. Many of our projects have been featured year after year for excellence in project management execution. Corporate governance is widely understood by many, and many people recognize the importance of it, and we're not different. And it is not only the hardware, it's also the software. And by the software, I mean the tone at the top, the mindset of the people, and the openness in being self-critical and ensuring you uphold yourself to the highest standards of business conduct. Starting off in terms of the key features of our corporate governance, we have diversified and highly experienced board of directors. As a matter of fact, we have three positions that are occupied by completely outside directors. Two are ex-CEOs of energy companies in the United States, and one ex-CEO of a financial institution. God bless him, passed away last year, but there is a replacement that is being looked at, hopefully, in the future. We also have bylaws governing corporate and management actions, and system of internal controls where there is segregation of duties, accountabilities, and prudent financial management. A very strong internal auditing function, as well as an independent external auditor that reports to the board. And we have deeply rooted corporate values that is supported with a very pragmatic conflict of interest policy. But I think more important than just having the hardware, the software is also important. And it is the mindset, it's the tone at the top that makes companies run well. We also recognize that technology is a key enabler for us. And my colleagues in the past came and talked to you about intelligent field development, advanced numeric simulations for our giant reservoirs, application of maximum reservoir contact wells, real-time geosteering, and we also look at our business processes, and we employ the largest business system integration utilizing SAP. All this cannot be done without talented and committed workforce. We have the largest corporate training program, and it is from the technician level all the way to advanced degree program. And we utilize it as the main source of recruitment for us, where we take people and help them achieve the highest of their potential career opportunities. We complement that with leadership and management development program and encourage learning as a lifelong journey. And we have self-development programs with a very strong e-learning network. We also recognize that excellence cannot be achieved by being excellent yourself, but also taking care of the environment and the people and the communities wherever you operate. And we espouse good corporate citizenship wherever we do business. And we render maximum support to the development of the local economies. And we do that, I want to emphasize, because it makes good business sense. Because if you have local supporting industries, you will be able to do your business better. You will have access to key business partners, suppliers, and manufacturers. We have outreach programs to raise the public awareness about health, safety, and the environment. And we uphold ourselves to the highest environmental standards. And our facilities, before we design them, we go through a very rigorous process to make sure that we conduct thorough environmental assessment, that the project execution includes specific environmental monitoring and mitigation programs, and we follow it up with monitoring. To summarize, critical to Saudi Aramco's success is a commitment to all stakeholders, global stakeholders, local stakeholders, as well as your shareholder by maintaining your commerciality. Sound management principles, good corporate governance, and talented workforce and advanced technology. In closing, I want to emphasize and say that this would have not been possible without truly the wisdom of our shareholder, who recognized from the onset that for this national oil company to succeed, they have to maintain a global perspective, a commitment to the kingdom needs, but also maintain commerciality and allow it to operate as a truly commercial enterprise. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Abdul Latif. This entire presentation is on the record. We will be posting the slides on our website. You should have at your seat question cards. If you'll fill those out, we can begin a Q&A session. And then just raise your hand so we can pick the cards up and bring them this way. Let me start. You talked about issues above the ground as opposed to the resource below the ground. Could you spend a little time talking about the research proposal and sequestration activity that Aramco is taking on?
Yeah. We have actually several environmental programs that we work with institutions here in the United States on carbon sequestration, on carbon management, on improvement to the internal combustion engine, as well as production of cleaner fuels. I'm pleased to say that last month we've hosted the first of its kind carbon management symposium in Saudi Arabia, and we were able to attract the best and the most credible scientists and researchers in the area and in the world. And it really underscores our commitment and our recognition that this is an issue that everybody has to work on collectively.
This question is directed at your financial background. You talked about your shareholder, which is different from what we have in this country. The question reads, would Aramco ever consider going public?
Well, it's really a shareholder. It's a shareholder decision. It's a shareholder decision to do that. But I think one has to recognize that national oil companies exist for a purpose. And as long as the national oil companies continue to provide the strategic purpose of its existence and maintain commercial viability, the shareholder will always be satisfied.
There you go. Good answer. This question relates to the fact that in the current global market, tight market as it is, but with rising prices, can you give us a sense of kind of behind-the-scenes activity that would lead the Saudi government and Aramco in particular to look at expanding productive capacity and maintaining productive capacity, spare capacity?
Well, I talked about the programs that we have with regards to our expansion program and the plan to increase our maximum sustained capacity from 10.8 to 12 million barrels by 2009. And that's a substantial investment and a commitment by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
So an ongoing commitment to make sure that the spare cushion is there.
And we have a commitment to always maintain 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day of spare capacity. It's an expensive one. However, it proved to be very important to bring in stability to the market and to respond to the market in terms of turmoil. But it's another example that only a strategic shareholder would make that decision and not a short-term commercially organization will be able to do.
This question looks like it's from someone in our IT department. We've heard before from Aramco executives that you process as much as four times the data that NASA does in a day. Approximately, what is your annual IT budget?
I don't have the exact answer, and I'm afraid it would be misleading because, you know, where do you draw the boundary when you talk about IT? But we have a substantial investment in IT.
Can you spend some time talking about security at APKIC and other facilities?
Yes. You know, given the vital nature of our facilities, we recognized for many years ago that we need to establish the strongest and the most robust security system. And we have done that through the years, both in terms of hardware and software. Recent terrorist activities in the region and around the world also alarmed us that we are facing a new and different challenge. And we moved swiftly and did further and substantial enhancements. Such capabilities were tested during the incident of APKIC and proved to be very sound and robust. And it is not only our system, but with close collaboration with the government who provides the security force in such situations. But it is something that is a high priority for us. We continue to be vigilant and careful, and we spare no effort to protect our people and our assets.
This relates to the market, the fact that global stocks are building worldwide. Reports indicate that Saudi Aramco has cut production from 9.4 to somewhere between 9.1 and 9.2 million barrels a day in the last few months. Could you tell us what the production approximately is currently and the reasons behind the cut as an assessment of the market change?
You know, our current production in the neighborhood of 9.5 million barrels a day. However, we offer whatever clears the market, and that's why it's not cut. It is whatever the market requires you supply.
If you have buyers,
yeah.
You mentioned greenfield refinery developments. Can you please speak to this in greater detail? Why you see investing in refining now?
Well, we invest for two reasons. One, we recognize that the whole industry needs to address the constraints and refining capacities worldwide. We're building two refineries in Saudi Arabia. We're building a refinery in the United States with our joint venture partner, and in other places. Yes, the refining business is cyclic by nature, but we picked locations that I think offers good market location United States, Saudi Arabia has the flexibility to serve many markets. Korea has a very nice balance between domestic needs and export flexibility. And China is a growth market. And we're investing in this because it makes good business sense. It responds to the customer. And we're probably we have the first mover advantage. We moved quickly on it.
This question relates to something that we actually discussed in the holding room prior to this, and it relates to people. American companies in the 1980s saw a huge number with the layoffs and the downturn in the industry that there's a gap now in the industry. A lot of older workers are retiring. Younger workers that were in their 20s in the early 1980s have reached a certain point, but in terms of management gains, we seem to have lost a generation. Mm-hmm. Has that happened to Saudi Aramco, and how are you coping with the personnel issue?
Yeah. As I mentioned, we have a very extensive talent development program, and we identify our needs for both technicians and professionals early. And our main source of recruitment are the people that we sponsor for such training, both vocational as well as advanced degree program, as well as professional and advanced degree program. And that allowed us to always maintain this pipeline of new and fresh talent coming into the company. With the expansion, obviously, we also face the need to increase the staffing requirements, and we've gone to the market to hire additional people. And we do recognize, just like everybody else, that there is a tightness, but we're in a much better situation because we've developed our people, and we have younger generations coming in through our scholarship programs.
Dr. Hamry alluded to this earlier. In terms of it used to be that a lot of Saudi students, and especially Aramco employees, had come to the United States for studying. With the visa problems, in terms of education, what's your secondary source of schooling, if you will?
Well, for a long time, most of the people we send for scholarship programs come to the United States. We appreciate the quality of the education, not only in the petroleum, but also the education experience in the United States. Unfortunately, with the visa situation, we had to rebalance and send people to other countries that offered good education, I must say, both Canada, United Kingdom, Australia. We also send people to China, Japan, and Korea. Mm-hmm. And that is also from a strategic standpoint because we wanted to breed a generation that appreciate the various cultures of the world. But we remain looking favorably at bringing in our students to the United States because truly we believe that the education experience in the United States is unique and offers great learning opportunities.
Earlier in your comments, you talked about how that the market fundamentals alone were responsible for current high prices. In your opinion, do speculators play a beneficial role in the market? And approximately how much can we attribute to hedging and speculation in terms of today's prices?
It's very hard to quantify how much they contribute. In theory, the forward market should bring in stability. However, the fact that the players are none, most of them are non-commercial, brings in a strong element of volatility. So it depends on who the players are, and that's why you see that there is a contribution to the volatility. As a matter of fact, some of the investors invest primarily because of the volatility.
Mm-hmm. Alan Greenspan testified in the Congress several weeks ago, and one of the comments he made in terms of investors and hedge funds was that they were accelerating the movement to realize higher prices. And what struck me was the Senate committee all nodded their heads, but if we had substituted gasoline service station owners in place of investors and said that they were just accelerating the trend that they saw coming if they'd get the same response. One of your slides showed The Economist. With hindsight, did The Economist get it wrong when they talked about the oil glut?
I think what it really emphasizes is that no one can get it right alone, and we need to have better communication with each other.
Infrastructure costs. In the past, it's been clear that Saudi Aramco and Saudi Arabia has some of the lowest cost reserves in the world. But how are increasing steel, engineering, and other upstream costs changing that figure?
Well, no doubt that the world is experiencing increased in cost of construction throughout the world. As I mentioned, we moved faster than others.
Mm-hmm.
We did witness increases in the price. We also introduced flexible contracting strategies to manage the risk and allocate it between us and the suppliers. Cost did go up, but not substantially. We continue to be amongst the lowest cost producers, for sure, if not the lowest.
There's been a lot of focus about production declines at Ghawar. Can you talk a little more specifically about what's actually going on in Ghawar and how long-lived the reserves are?
Well, I was asked about the question also last night, and Ghawar remains healthy, producing 5 million barrels a day, has been doing that for several decades and will continue to do that for the decades to come. Water cut ratio is quite impressive and coming down. So it's in good shape and in good health.
This question is on refining capacity and refining investments. Do you see a move with the differential between light sweet crudes and heavy sour? Will there be more investment in capacity expansions or just deep conversion capacity to take advantage of the price differential?
I think you will see both, but more and more for deep conversion and for heavier crudes.
We talked about production increments through 2009. I'm asking you to put on your forward-thinking hat. What increments do you see coming on after 2009? And is 15 million barrel a day a target for Saudi Aramco?
As we saw from the economist slide, it's very hard to read the future. Let's wait and see, and we'll be ready.
Excellent answer. We had Guy Caruso here earlier this week, and we talked about everything from weather and hurricanes to sabotage and what's going on in the market activity. Clearly, there's a consensus emerging around here that it's the above-the-ground issues. If you could change things to promote stability in the world, what two or three things do you think would most mitigate instability and bring prices down?
Well,
not putting you on the spot.
I truly believe that peace brings prosperity. And given the fact that the majority of the oil resources are in the Middle East, it is just my hope and wish that soon we will enjoy a peaceful region that will allow us to continue our contribution to the world and providing energy to the world.
Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who many in this audience knows, recently talked about Saudi Arabia taking a Chinese wife. But in addition to the relationship with the U.S. in a multiple partner marriage, do you foresee China displacing or replacing the United States, or it's just an additional purchaser for Saudi oil?
When you're the largest producer and exporter, everyone is your number one customer.
Well done. Conflict with Iran. I'm actually surprised that it took this long to get to this. What do you think in terms of impact on price if there isn't a diplomatic solution?
Well, let's hope for a diplomatic. As I mentioned, the region is in dire need for peace and prosperity on all the fronts. It was very clear, you know, the recent hopeful indications about Iran and its effect on the prices. It went down by $3 when we heard good news that there is an easy easing of the tense situation in Iran. So let's hope that takes place and that people have very successful negotiation to address the international community as well as the needs of Iran.
We've pretty much exhausted the questions. I think your clear presentation, different focus today, we very much appreciate it. But we very much appreciate this ongoing dialogue with Aramco and
Thank
Saudi
you.
Arabia.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Please join me in thanking you.
Thank you.